This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
Israel races to eradicate Hamas as calls for a ceasefire in Gaza mount. And how investors are taking stock as the cost of clean energy is rising.
People are coming to terms with the reality that the energy transition needs to make economic sense. Investors are not going to invest in clean energy only for the sake of reducing carbon emissions. They need to generate returns.
Plus, what are the risks of the private credit boom? It's Friday, November 10th. I'm Anne-Marie Fratoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that moved the world today. Israeli ground forces have fought their way into Gaza's urban areas in a little over a week as international pressure mounts to prevent civilian deaths and ease worsening humanitarian conditions. Israel aims to eliminate Hamas, and officials have said they won't accept a ceasefire or a pause in fighting until hostages are released. Despite the speed of Israel's advance, which has surprised even their own commanders, the most challenging stages of the war may still lie ahead. Here now to explain is Wall Street Journal correspondent David Cloud. David, Israel has fought into the heart of Gaza City. What are the biggest challenges now as it looks to destroy Hamas?
The biggest challenge, no doubt, is the tunnel complex that they say is underneath large parts of Gaza City, and where Israel says Hamas's leaders, fighters, hostages, and ammo are located. So the question sort of becomes, now that they've reached the kind of center of the city, how do they attack those tunnels without jeopardizing the lives of the hostages, if possible, at the same time accomplishing their goal, which is to destroy Hamas's leadership. This is a long-term battle as far as Israel is concerned. And one of the things they want is time to carry out the full extent of their plans. Whether they get that or not is another issue.
What is Hamas's goal?
Hamas's goal is to sort of stay alive amid this massive Israeli invasion. Their immediate goal will be to use the hostages to generate pressure on Israel to pause the fighting or even, although Israel denies it will ever do so, agree to a ceasefire. So they are looking for maybe a stalemate in northern Gaza so that they can hold on and not be decimated by Israel's advancing forces, as Israel claims they want to do.
At the same time, we are seeing growing international pressure to protect civilians and provide humanitarian aid. How are Israeli forces balancing that with the goal to eradicate Hamas?
I mean, that's a good question. Thousands of Palestinians have been killed. Israel says that it's working to move Palestinian civilians, non-combatants, out of the north and urge them to go to the south. It's opened multiple corridors for them to do so and sent out various forms of messages encouraging them to do so. An unknown number, thousands we're told, are potentially still around many hospitals in the north, including Al-Shifa Hospital, which is a main target of Israel. They say that's being used by Hamas as kind of a command center, and they've surrounded the hospital. Hamas has said since this invasion started that they're not using civilians as human shields, and our ability to parse those claims is limited because Gaza is a war zone and it's hard to figure out what the truth is. So these are difficult questions and difficult military issues to kind of separate non-combatants from combatants, and Israel says they're doing their best. Some people say they're not doing well enough.
That's Wall Street Journal correspondent David Cloud. And as part of our continuing coverage, we'll have a special edition of What's News tomorrow, answering your questions about the Israel-Hamas war. That will be available tomorrow morning, wherever you get your podcasts. The U.S. and China have made it official, confirming that President Biden and Chinese leader Xi Jinping will meet for a summit in San Francisco next week. Next Wednesday will be the first time the two have met face-to-face in a year. Senior Biden administration officials have previewed a lengthy agenda and some trouble spots that are likely to come up, including the Israel-Hamas war, North Korea, and China's support for Russia's war on Ukraine. The U.S. also wants China's help choking off exports of chemicals that drug cartels use to make fentanyl. And according to people briefed on the preparations, Beijing is looking for some breathing room in economic relations with the U.S. and assurances on Taiwan, the self-ruled democratic island that Beijing claims. Both governments have set modest expectations for the summit. Coming up, how executives are weighing the benefits of cleaner energy with the rising costs. More after the break.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
The costs of transitioning to green energy are getting higher. And according to investment firm executives, that has many investors weighing the risks of financing these projects against the benefits of reducing carbon emissions. Here now to explain is Luis Garcia, who covers private equity fundraising for Wall Street Journal Pro. Luis, why are costs for green energy rising?
Well, they are rising for different reasons. First of all, they are rising because interest rates are rising. So all these projects, they need loans, they need financing. So the cost of capital is now higher. But also, you know, there's rising labor costs, there are supply chain issues, trade policies. You know, we have the efforts that all these countries are making to bring manufacturing back home that could be beneficial in the long term. In the short term, it can create shortage of equipment that increase costs, prices.
What are we hearing from executives about that?
What these rising costs are showing, you know, people are coming to terms with the reality that the energy transition needs to make economic sense. Investors are not going to invest in clean energy only for the sake of reducing carbon emissions. They need to generate returns. So as costs increase, energy prices increase, so that affordability becomes a more important issue. One of the things that this executive said, he mentioned this triangle between affordability, sustainability, and also reliability, because there's also technological challenges, right? We are putting more and more intermittent renewable power into a grid that was not designed for that. So investors are trying to find the right balance between those three things, you know, affordability, sustainability, and reliability.
So when we talk about that affordability piece, what have the rising costs meant for the market?
Well, it means that as energy becomes more expensive, somebody's going to have to pay the bill, or the government may have to play a bigger role, or some say a smarter role. Because, you know, there's a lot of incentives for clean energy out there. You know, we have the Inflation Reduction Act, but it's not only a matter of financial incentives. You know, there are a lot of things that government can do to reduce costs in the energy transition. And the important one is this interconnection problem in the grids. This is increasing costs for renewable energy because these new projects, they have sometimes to wait years so they can be connected to the grid.
That's Wall Street Journal Pro reporter Luis Garcia. Corporate borrowing has been moving from banks and the bond market into private funds. But the boom in private credit is raising new questions about the risks. To find out more, S&P Global Ratings conducted an analysis of about 2,000 private corporate borrowers with more than $400 billion in debt between them. Here now to talk about the findings is Wall Street Journal investigative reporter Ben Foldy. Ben, this is a booming market. What did this analysis find about the risks?
So it's a booming market and it's an opaque one, the private and private credit. Indicates that it doesn't have all the same kind of disclosures and documentation that you'd expect to see with other forms of debt like bonds, which are rated. You have reams and reams of disclosure about the risks. And in private credit, you don't have that. A lot of this lending has gone to what are called middle market companies. So companies between a few hundred million and $1 billion in market cap that are privately held. And private credit has put a lot of money into that sector over the last couple of years, especially as banks have pulled back. And the risk is that a lot of these companies, you know, they're smaller, they're already highly levered, so they've already got a lot of borrowing. They may be kind of earlier stage companies, more speculative. They don't necessarily have a lot of cash flow. And they just generally are kind of riskier borrowers from a debt perspective.
Was it all bad news?
No, it's not all bad news. I think one thing that caught the attention of the people that did the analysis was that they did find that these companies are highly leveraged and you know, susceptible to a downturn. But they also found that the liquidity situation that most of them have at the moment is pretty decent. And the other note of optimism is that a lot of this debt won't mature for the next few years. Only about $30 billion is set to mature next year. And then it goes up to about $60 billion after that and $100 billion after that. So there is kind of a maturity wall, but it's a few years down the road. So there's definitely still some runway left for these companies.
Wall Street Journal investigative reporter Ben Foldy. In other news, Honda is boosting pay for many of its U.S. factory workers by 11% and making other improvements for those employees. The base wage increase is effective in January, according to a memo viewed by the Wall Street Journal. It's another sign of how quickly the gains won by the United Auto Workers Union in its negotiations with Detroit automakers are rippling through the broader industry. Honda's decision follows Toyota's lead in keeping pay competitive for assembly line workers. Earlier this month, Toyota raised wages for most U.S. factory workers by 9%. Neither Toyota nor Honda's U.S. factories are unionized. And we report exclusively that Disney is weighing whether its future should include fewer TV networks. People familiar with the matter say executives are reviewing the company's channels to determine which have long-term value and which can be sold. So far, ABC, Disney Channel, and FX have been identified as the most valuable. The review found the National Geographic Channel and Freeform are less critical to the company. CEO Bob Iger said in an interview on CNBC on Wednesday that Disney's review has identified opportunities to cut costs and improve the business, suggesting it might not unload assets. And that's what's news for this week. Today's show was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé and Anthony Bansi. What's News is hosted by me, Anne-Marie Fertoli, and Luke Vargas. Additional support this week from Jessica Fenton, Michael Laval, and Christina Roca. Our supervising producers are Sandra Kilhoff and Michael Kosmides. Aisha Al-Muslim is our development producer. Scott Salloway and Chris Sinsley are our deputy editors. And Falana Patterson is The Wall Street Journal's head of news audio. And remember, we'll be back with a special episode tomorrow morning with our answers to questions from you, our listeners, about the Israel-Hamas war. Be sure to listen.